This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Familiar Strangers, written by Jackie Walsh, performed by Kelly Burke. Prologue. The light is dimming now, casting shadows all around, but I continue to dig, dragging up soil, tossing it aside, digging out more. Lifting my hand, I rub the water from my eyes. Rain? Tears? I no longer know. Sirens whine in the distance, getting louder, closer. I have to find it, take it from the ground. It's what she wanted, what she asked for. Rain blurs my vision, seeping through my t-shirt and soaking my skin, running down my front, down my back, filling my shoes. I glance up at the house looming in the darkness. A gust of wind catches the broken guttering, banging it against the wall. Bang, bang, bang. I'm alone here, which is what I want. The hole is already filling with water, so I work quicker, making it wider, wishing the gathering pool away. To my right, I see a plant pot caught below a plank of wood. It cracks when I pull it free. Sweeping the pools of water into the pot, I pour it to the side, but the more I bail, the quicker it fills up again. My eyes burn as I look up at the sky and feel the rain sting my face. I think I see him in the shapes created by the dark, menacing clouds rolling past, hiding the stars, hiding the moon. Help me, God. Please, help me. I dig again. Harder and harder, grabbing at the earth until finally my fingers catch on something hard. My breathing stops. Tugging and pulling, I haul the box out of the ground and open it. Removing the bundle from inside, I lay it on the grass, let the rain wash it clean. The bag is badly worn and torn in places, but it's still pretty much intact. With one finger, I press on its hard contents. My hand reaches to my forehead, painting a mud cross on my face. The storm rages on around me, but now I feel calm inside, more at peace than I have ever felt before. Stretching out my hand, I place it on top of the bundle and gently press down on the tiny skeleton. Chapter 1. I hate walking through these doors. Failing bodies shuffling past the white walls and cheerful pictures, struggling to get their feet to take them wherever it is they want to go. The dining room, the TV room, the family room, there's not a lot of choice. When I get to Mom's door, I take a deep breath and cross my fingers. Will she know me? The gentle music humming in the background does nothing to ease my tension. My heart is beating a little faster, my stomach twisting into a knot. This is not how it was supposed to be. I try to put a smile on my face, but it's hard. Hard when I know that what's behind this door will crush me as it does every time. Mom, lying on her sanitized bed, surrounded by photos, flowers, a beaker with some Disney character smiling on it, unaware of anything. Reduced to the package she came in. A body that is also beginning to fade. The doctors say her breathing is becoming more labored, her swallow weakening, her legs no longer able to hold her up. The little things she could do, like hold a spoon or run a brush through her hair, have all disappeared over the past few weeks. Getting her mouth to open is the new goal. When that goes, we're all in trouble. A nurse stands with her back to me when I enter the room, blocking my view of Mom and glancing around when she hears the door. For a brief moment, I pause, waiting for her reaction. If everything is okay, the nurse will have a smile and a big hello. If things are bad today, she will whisper gently. I know these signs off by heart now. Holding my breath, I wait while she presses the controller on the bed, moving Mom into a raised position. When she's lying flat, she looks like a corpse, and it scares the hell out of me.
Hello, Rebecca,
the nurse says, nice and loud and cheery, easing my stress and letting Mom know that I've arrived.
Nancy, Rebecca is here.
I tilt my head to see Mom, but there's no response. Her glossy eyes are locked on the nurse, looking at her like she's trying to figure out what she is.
Your daughter is here. Rebecca is here.
I fix my eyes on Mom, willing a reaction. Know me, Mom. Please. Know me. Her lips pinch together. Slowly, she moves her head in my direction, lifting my heart in the process. A smile moves the corners of her sagging face, releasing the chains that grip my body. I want to jump around the room and shout out loud, "She knows me. She knows me."
You look lovely today, Mom.
I lie. The tide has gone out on my mother's eyes. They were the first thing I saw each morning when I was a little girl, those eyes, the color of the sea. Good morning, baby, she would say. Pulling the chair in closer to the bed, I sit to talk to her, telling her day-to-day stuff about work, how I'm settling into my apartment, the new shoes I bought the other day in the mall. But it's painful watching her struggle to understand what I'm saying. I tell her about Joanna, my brother Danny's wife, expecting the baby. She's been told this 100 times, but I have to keep talking, anything to dull the awful reality of this silence. After a few minutes of me babbling on, my mother interrupts. Becca, she murmurs through the small gap her lips will allow. Delighted to hear her say my name, I pull the chair in as close as possible to the bed. I better start the supper, she says. Your father be home soon. This often happens, her mind going back to days long spent, to moments that revisit her as if they are happening now.
I'll help you,
I say in my best play along with her voice. But I don't get an answer. Mom is someplace else now, somewhere only she recognizes. Her hand slowly reaches out, trying to grab something from the air. There's nothing there, nothing I can see. Hopelessness surges through my veins. This is desperate. How much more of this can I handle? Tears sting my eyes, asking me to cry, but I won't cry, not in front of her. Instead, I stand up and tuck the sheets in at the side of the bed. Another few minutes pass with my mother's slow, swaying hand clearing the air. It's only when the nurse returns that she stops.
Are you staying to feed, Nancy?
The nurse says, placing a tray on the trolley by the end of the bed. Yes, if that's okay, I say, watching the nurse press the bed controller and move Mom, like a robot, into a fully upright position. We've been told how important it is that the food goes straight down. Very important, they said, especially with Mom's swallow weakening. If particles of food are inhaled into her lungs, she could get pneumonia. And that, they said, would be the end of her. We were also told that eventually her brain will forget how to swallow altogether, and Mom's life will be preserved by a plastic tube. I'm dreading it.
This looks lovely.
I lie again, pulling the tray closer to me, opening the napkin while the nurse makes my mother comfortable, fluffing up the pillows at her back.
Your daughter is going to feed you today, Nancy. Aren't you a lucky woman?
Then the nurse walks out of the room, leaving a pile of mush on a plate that looks like someone has already had a go at eating it. The grayish goo makes me want to gag, but I better not. Taking the spoon in my hand, I scoop up a tiny piece and lift it towards the lucky woman's lips, but Mom moves her head away from it. You're not my daughter, she says. Mom, it's me, Becca. I know it's you, Becca. You're not my daughter. Grabbing my arm, her bony fingers wrap around my wrist. You're not my daughter. She repeats, and although she's freaking me out, I laugh. I can't help it. Things can be very funny in this hopeless situation. Of course I'm your daughter, Mom. I'm Rebecca. She tugs at my wrist, wanting me to move closer to her, so I do. Put Rover in the ground, Danny. Don't cry, Danny. Rover's gone to heaven. Now she's worrying me. Her face has turned an even paler shade of white than I've become used to, and she's getting very agitated. Her eyes are filled with fear, staring at me, scaring me. Stop, Mom. But her grip is tightening, shaking my arm. It's Rebecca, Mom. I'm here beside you, I say, willing her to relax, to take her mind someplace else, anywhere else. And even though her words have turned to meaningless sounds now, fear is still carved all over her face. Then it stops. She lets go of her grip and sags back into the pillows, her eyes wet with tears. Slowly, she lifts her hand to stroke my hair, taking me back to when I was that little girl, the one she cared for. I move my face closer to hers, to where her warm breath heats my skin, comforting me. Then Mom jerks her head up from the pillow, and I jump back in the chair. Her eyes are open wide, staring at me, staring through me. Her usually lifeless eyes are alive with a fear so intense it's scaring me. I want to cry, to tell her she'll be okay, but she is desperately trying to tell me something. I know it. Taking her hand, I squeeze it gently, but she continues to stare, to scare. What is it, Mom? What are you trying to tell me? I took you, Becca. You're not my daughter. Chapter 2. The parking lot is empty when I step outside, unlike my head, which is about to explode. What did she mean? Why did she say she took me? For over an hour, I sat there trying to get her to explain, to drag her mind back to where it was when she said those words, I took you, Becca. But it was a complete waste of time. Her thoughts had moved on to whatever dream, hallucination, or flashback had decided to visit her. Turning the key in the ignition, I drive the expressway, watching the dark clouds gather in the distance above Boston City. What I'd really like to do is go to the nearest liquor store, get the biggest bottle of red wine I can find, and saturate my anxiety. Maybe later, when I finish my shift. I go through the shadow of the Hancock Tower and negotiate the tight space that leads to the underground parking lot of my very expensive one-bed apartment. It's the location, the realtor announced when my face couldn't hide the shock at the rent. By the river, Fenway Park, just a short stroll away, and the famous Cheers Bar, which, for some reason, he felt important to mention, just a few blocks to the left. If it wasn't for my second job, working behind the bar at Maddie's a couple of nights a week, I'd never be able to afford it. After parking my car, I stand in the lobby waiting on the elevator to arrive. Jeff, the guy who lives for free in an apartment a few doors up from mine, comes rushing in. He's house-sitting for his sister, an environmental lawyer who's currently living in Europe and needs someone to feed her rabbits. Nice work if you can get it.
Hi, Becca,
he says, his long, lean body towering over me.
Are you in Maddie's tonight?
Sure am. Are you coming down? The elevator screeches to a halt, and we step inside. Jeff punches the button for the 10th floor.
Not tonight, sorry. Big date.
Jeff always has a big date. Fit and tanned, his black hair shaved tight around the edges but dangling like a cocker's ears on top, he goes through women like he's testing them out for someone else. Which means I shouldn't really like him, but I do. We met the day I moved in when the bottom fell out of the box I was carrying, scattering my privacy across the floor in the lobby. Jeff arrived at the scene, helped me gather up my belongings and carry them to my apartment. Later that day, he called in with a bottle of wine, and we've been friends since. Just friends. Jeff is one of the few people I speak to in this building. Ms. Canister is another, an old lady who hasn't realized it yet.
Call me Sophie,
she demands when I address her as Ms. Canister. Her wardrobe is more exciting than my own, and she carries an iPhone with her at all times that no one has ever seen her use. Her age is a closely guarded secret, but the maintenance guy reckons she had a sister who died 5 years ago, aged 90. The lift jolts to a halt. Jeff rushes down the corridor, all systems go, leaving me strolling behind. Good luck with the date, I shout, before crossing to my apartment and letting myself in. 22A is a small space, but it has a floor-to-ceiling window that makes my world look a lot bigger than it actually is. Sometimes I sit in front of that window for hours, staring out at the tall gray buildings beyond, wondering about the lives of those strangers who come and go, come and go. Below me, the street is quiet. Most people who work around here empty out to the suburbs once 6 o'clock arrives. In between the two tallest buildings, a narrow siding of Boston Common hangs like nature's clock. Browns, yellows, reds. In the summer, it's green. A few blocks down to my right, the Great Charles River flows, unhindered by market value. If I get right up against the glass and crane my neck, I can see the water glisten in the sunlight. Below the moon, it's like black oil. I drop my bag onto the coffee table, switch on the light, and straight away know something is wrong. Someone has been in here. I tiptoe into the middle of the room, my heart bouncing in my chest. There doesn't seem to be anything out of place. Everything seems okay. Holding my breath, I listen for the sound of someone moving, someone breathing. But there's no sound of life, just the usual clank from the archaic heating system. The bedroom door is open, so I stick my head in. Just my head. I'm not going in alone. There's no one there. Mom's words must have me on edge. Relax, Becca. Take a deep breath, make a strong cup of coffee. The kitchen area is about 4 feet long and 2 feet wide, with everything squashed into it, including the kitchen sink. To make any kind of a decent meal, I would have to be an especially dedicated member of Cirque du Soleil, which I'm not. Boiling water and reheating takeaways is about as much as I can pull off without doing myself damage. Slipping off my jacket, I make for the kettle when I notice a pile of clothes neatly stacked on the floor beside the cabinet. What the? Those clothes were on top of it when I left this morning. Someone was here. Someone searched the cabinet. My heart races as I sprint down the corridor, banging on Jeff's door. Jeff! Jeff! What's wrong? He says when he finally answers, tucking in the top of a towel he has wrapped around his waist. He runs his hands through dripping hair, pushing it away from his face. I think someone broke into my apartment.
Seriously?
He says, already pulling his door closed behind him, following me down the corridor. Back in my apartment, Jeff looks around, then at me. He was expecting chaos, I guess. To his eyes, I know it all looks as it should, or maybe even a bit cleaner than usual.
I don't get it,
he says. That pile of laundry, Jeff. I left it on top of the cabinet.
No way,
he grins.
Someone broke in and moved your clothes? We better call the FBI.
You're not listening, Jeff. I left those clothes on the cabinet. Someone's been in here.
You're sure?
I'm certain. The grin slips away.
Is anything missing?
He says, walking around, leaving damp footprints, one hand gripping his towel, which, for a brief moment, I imagine him dropping. I don't know. I haven't had time to check.
But you're certain that's where the clothes were when you left?
I nod.
Maybe they fell down,
he says. Into a neat pile and in the same order they were in before? He shrugs, slides me another grin, the kind you use when what you really want to do is growl. Jeff doesn't believe me. He thinks I've simply forgotten I moved them, and he doesn't want to waste any more time in my apartment when he's already under pressure to get to his, no doubt, extremely hot date.
You want to ring the cops?
He says with a sigh. No, I say. That's okay. Maybe you're right. I must have moved them and forgot about it. I give him a push. You go. Get ready. And thanks.
No problem.
After I lock the door behind him, I investigate more thoroughly, but there doesn't seem to be anything missing. It's not long before I find myself wondering if Jeff was right. Did I move the laundry? No, I didn't. I know I didn't. Why would I move it to the floor? Then I see it. I'm in the bedroom when I notice the photo, face down on the bedside cabinet. Someone was in here. That photo is always standing. My eyes open to it every morning, searching out her smile. I place the frame upright and a chill runs down my spine. I'm icy cold. Looking around, I see nothing else has been touched, just this photo. Why? Who? And how did they get in? The spare key is out at my dad's house, and I doubt Dad even knows how to find my place. There's Lenny, of course. Lenny the concierge. Lenny, the security guy, he's got a bunch of keys, one for each apartment in the building. Would Lenny have handed over my key? Or could someone have swiped the keys from behind Lenny's desk in the lobby? Ms. Canister is always complaining about Lenny falling asleep on the job, says he spends more time counting sheep than counting visitors. I'll ask him on my way out. Now I have to get ready for my shift at Maddie's. Heading for the bathroom, the apartment feels different somehow, as if it has betrayed me. Everything looks okay, but the silence is eerie, so I switch on the TV and leave it playing in the background. After a quick shower, makeup, clothes, and shoes, I'm ready. But just as I'm about to walk out the door, TV remote already in hand, I get distracted by the face on the screen. A woman is missing, apparently. Katie Collins. According to the anchor, she hasn't been in contact with her family for days, and they're all very concerned. Taking a step closer to the screen, I scan the young woman's features. Blonde hair, pulled tightly into a braid, blue eyes, gleaming above a slight smile, and skin that mustn't welcome the sun. It's as pale as my own. Katie Collins looks familiar. Chapter 3. Maddie's is a place of dim lighting and threadbare velvet, pocked wooden stools and sprung sofas, pre-owned air and Zeppelin blasting from the speakers, all of it infused with a tingling anticipation that anything might happen. I pass Al and Dawn, who stand by the entrance door every night, each of them with that seen-it-all-before expression nailed to his face. I've never seen them dressed other than they are tonight. Black leather jackets, iconic band t-shirts, and Al in jeans that he somehow, magically, manages to close over his bulging beer belly. Maddie's gets an older crowd, so Al and Dawn don't often need to flex their muscles. Checking ID is their main job. The clients, which is how Matt insists we refer to them, come to listen to the music, to nod along to bass riffs and guitar solos, gaping in awe at the finger-hopping Wally executes on the Fender. I drop my bag in the changing room and head out to the bar. Maddie's is renowned for two things. Once a famous baseball player, Maddie broke his neck sliding into home base 7 years ago, and now runs his business from an ergonomic wheelchair, as seen on Dr. Phil. And Aerosmith played here a couple of years back. A couple of decades back, to be precise, long before Matt Henley bought the place, but that didn't stop him putting a big sign on the wall making sure everyone knows Boston's bad boys once darkened these doors. The night drags on until Brian, the head barman, tells me I can finish early. The bar is not as busy as usual. In the changing room, I strip off the black shirt with Maddie's logo stitched onto the left breast pocket and slip into a plain white t-shirt. The anxiety is already creeping back, prickling under my skin. What did Mom mean? Who was in my apartment? Passing the storeroom on the way back to the bar, I almost trip over a cardboard box outside the door. I peek inside to see if it's empty. It isn't. 7 bottles, all gin. After a quick glance around, I take one of the bottles and tuck it into the bottom of my bag. Then I head through to the bar, where Brian asks if I'm having a drink. I think about it, not sure if I should add poison to anxiety. But I tell him I will. Just the one.
Everything okay?
Brian says, as he sets down the vodka and soda.
Fine, yeah. Do I not look okay?
Terrific, honey, as always. I just thought you were a bit quiet tonight.
There's a surprise. I didn't know Brian paid any attention to me. I'm fine, Brian, really. Bit of a rough day is all.
I hear that.
He says, pushing the vodka closer.
Get that into you.
I do.
Then I do it again. And again.
Soon my mood is mellowing out, the bar and its bustle fading in the background. Then, Stephen Black walks in the door.
I am so not in the mood for this.
With more confidence than a 3-year-old drawing a picture, Stephen Black thinks every woman is just dying to sleep with him. Some probably are. Not me, though. I don't go for married men. From the far side of the bar, I can deal with his advances, laughing, pretending to be flattered. It's not a good idea to burst your boss's bubble when you're a month away from being made permanent. But I don't know how to deal with him from this side. Maybe he'll behave like he does in the office, Mr. Nice Guy, showing respect for everyone as he waits to be made partner. With the alcohol swimming through my veins, Mom's words drilling through my brain, I'm not sure I care.
Hey, Becca,
he says, leaning against the counter with a big grin. He introduces the 2 guys with him, but I don't catch their names. If they're not drunk, they're well on the way. Stephen orders a round, including me in the order. Should I stay or go? I stay. Soon, I'm even enjoying the attention. The vodka working its magic. Now his hand is on my back, sending a warmth through me. This is good. This is how I want to feel, although I do find myself wondering which hand is on my back. The one with the wedding ring?
Don't do it, Becca. Walk away.
I know, but...
But what?
Don't I deserve a bit of fun after the day I've had?
Fun, sure, but this guy's married.
Then Stephen leans in and suggests we go someplace else, whispering in my ear, his warm breath starting the party. Ignoring the old Becca, the strong Becca, the one who seems to be losing control more and more, I agree. Back at my apartment. Now that's what I call Music 77 plays on the tinny stereo that cost $100 in a Music Depot flash sale. It came with 2 free CDs. The only CDs I have. Stephen is spread out over the sofa, watching me pour us both a glass from the bottle of gin. It doesn't take him long to make his move. Within minutes, we are both naked on the bed. My head is spinning, my heart is swelling, my body vibrates. Ignoring how wrong it all is, I continue making love, or shagging, or whatever it's called when you're fucking someone else's husband. But, I tell myself, just don't get caught and no one will get hurt. It's that simple. For me, anyway. I don't have to go home and lie to the love of my life about where I've been and what I've done. How will Stephen do that? Does he worry he might get caught? I don't think so. It doesn't seem to bother him at all. Hot and all as the guy might be, he's cold enough to be able to detach himself from what he's doing. I'm glad he's not my husband. A couple of hours pass before Stephen glances at the fancy gold watch on his wrist and shuffles out of the bed. I imagine it's worth a lot of money, that watch.
I'll have to go soon,
he says, turning and bumping into the photo that he knocks off the nightstand. Watching his lean, naked body bend down to pick it up, I lie there, feeling content and awful at the same time. What did I just do? Stephen is holding the photo in his hand, scanning the faces peering back at him.
Who are all these?
My family. I'm not comfortable with Stephen meeting my family like this. Mom and Dad, and that's Danny. I feel sad when I say Mom. It doesn't sound right. Should I say that was my mom? In the picture, she's standing by my side, her face wreathed in a smile. Long, dark hair hangs loosely around her face, shiny red lipstick vibrant on her lips. There is happiness in Mom's smile. Real happiness, not the Kodak type. In fact, we all look happier in that captured second than we do now. Photos can do that. Make you think life was better years ago, that things were simpler in the past. For the people in that photo, they were.
You don't look like your mother,
Stephen observes. He puts the photo back on the nightstand and walks out the door, cool as ice cream on a winter's day. The bang of the door closing behind him sounds extra loud. I lie still on the bed, staring at the ceiling, wondering why his words made me feel afraid. His casual comment surges through me as if I've been injected with panic. Why wouldn't I look like my mother? Bolting upright, I take some deep breaths. Relax, Becca, relax. Then I let my eyes slowly move to the picture on the nightstand, to the mother who looks like me. Does she? Chapter 4. The next day, I head for Dad's with a terrible headache. He likes to have us all around the same table for Sunday lunch, the way we used to before Mom went away. It takes me 20 minutes to get to Dorchester and pull up outside the blue wooden house with the white porch where I grew up. I see Danny and Joanna's people carrier hogging the driveway, leaving me to park on the street. They bought the big car because the baby is on the way. Always prepared for what life has in store. I hope it stays that way. For Danny's sake, especially. He's not good with changes to the script. Everything has to be mapped out and planned to perfection. Not like me. I never know what's on the next page. I finally squeeze into a tight space between two cars. I see Bert in his yard, leaning on a rake, and I wave over to him. Hi, Bert. How's Edith?
She's fine. She'd be better for seeing you, though.
I'll be over as soon as lunch is finished.
She'll be happy to hear that.
Except Edith won't hear that. Edith is old, older than Bert, and things are slowly breaking down on her. Her hearing was the first gift to be taken back almost 2 years ago now. But she's in the hands of a good man who carries on like nothing has changed. Bert shuffles off and I step up onto the front porch of my family home. Or what used to be a home when Mom still lived here. Before the big hole appeared at the heart of it. Not a hole you can see. One you can feel. At first it was all a joke, passing comments no one paid any heed to. Oh, I can't remember what I came in here for. Or, do I want a cup of tea or did I just have one? Then she would laugh and let it go. until one day the local store rang to say my mother was in the manager's office because she had forgotten how to get home. I remember that moment like it is happening now. The fear that gripped me, tossing me into a place I never want to go back to. My father coming through the kitchen door, whistling, a rope and a hammer in his hand, then seeing my face and dropping the tools, rushing to my side.
What's wrong, Becca?
We're still getting the answer to that question. It comes in dribs and drabs from week to week, month to month, slowly torturing us, feeding us death through a drip.
Here she is,
Joanna says, her voice traveling out through the open window. Here she is. Not, hi, Becca, or how are you, Becca? Here she is, implying everyone was discussing why I'm late. Oblivious to my paranoia, my father walks in from the backyard. His face is pale, and he's aging at a rapid pace. There are swollen bags beneath his sad eyes, and his hair is now completely gray.
How's my favorite daughter?
He says, giving me a hug before trudging back out to the yard. Through the window, I can see him watching Danny, who's fixing something near the shed at the bottom of the yard. The pride never leaves my dad's stare as he watches him. I know what he's thinking. My son. Big, strong Danny with all his degrees and important job in the tall glass building. Not to mention his beautiful wife and eco-friendly home the size of a small hotel that he's about to garnish with a baby. I imagine all Dad's friends down the pub are sick of hearing him talking about himself. Nicholas Wall, the mechanic, whose son is making it big in the corporate world. But it keeps Dad happy. He needs something to be happy about. Maybe I'll make him happy someday. Mom was different. She never cared for suits and breakfast meetings. Having us around, healthy and happy, was enough for her, she told me. Mom harbored no dreams for me that I didn't dream for myself. She loved Danny, but she super loved me. Danny lifts his head. There are times I think he's growing into my dad. That same jawline jutting out, same square head. He sees me watching, nods and smiles. If he knew I'd slept with my boss last night, I would not be seeing that smile. Rummaging in the kitchen dresser for some hangover relief, I find a packet of Advil and take two out of the pack.
How's Nancy?
Joanna says, her false eyelashes lined up like synchronized swimmers preparing to dive into her eyes. Fine. The same as usual, I say, filling a glass with water. I don't want to get into the details of what my mother said. Not with Joanna. After swallowing the tablets, I unzip my jacket and fling it onto the closest chair. Please let her move on to the next subject. I can't handle this today, not with this blinding headache and burning guilt.
Poor Nancy, she says. It's so sad seeing her like that.
She pauses for a moment, giving me a flicker of hope. But no, here she comes again.
Have you ever thought about getting tested for the gene?
She says, just as Danny walks in the door. Not really, I say.
It's just, with your mom having gotten it so young, you should maybe think about it.
It kills me to admit it. But Joanna has a point. My mom is one of the youngest ever to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the Mass General Hospital. Early onset familial Alzheimer's disease, to be exact, or EFAD, which is different to the more common one that older people get, LOD. Which means mom has a 55-year-old heart in what looks like a 105-year-old body with a less than a 5-second memory. Nowadays, they know a lot more about the gene that carries the possibility of this elongated death sentence. Sure. There is a possibility that I may have inherited the gene, so I will think about getting tested. Whenever I have spare money. Or top-tier health insurance like Danny. I just don't want to discuss it now. Not with Joanna, and definitely not with Danny.
What are you talking about?
Danny says, washing his hands. Danny is a lot taller than me, keeps himself fit, and has parted his hair the exact same way for as long as I can remember. His clothes always sport an expensive logo, so they'll do his boasting for him. And he is always doing something, anything. He can't just sit down or keep still.
Nothing much, Joanna says, handing him a paper towel. I was just asking Becca if she'd thought about getting tested for the Alzheimer's gene.
And why would she want to do that?
He says, drying his hands a little too vigorously.
I just thought, Joanna says, turning away.
Well, don't. Becca has no interest in getting tested.
Then, for her sake or mine, or his, I can't really be sure, he turns to me.
Do you, Becca?
Does she what?
Says Dad, walking in.
Get tested,
Danny says.
It's no big deal, Joanna says. I only asked Becca if she'd considered getting tested for the EFAD gene.
And what did she say?
Dad says. It's like I'm not even here.
That she's not sure?
Joanna says, turning to look at me.
You're not sure?
Dad says. I stare back blankly and shrug, hoping it will quieten them. But no, in jumps Danny with my answer all prepared for me.
Becca won't be getting tested for any gene,
he says.
Why the hell would she want to know if that nightmare was waiting for her?
He puts an arm around Joanna, pulling her close and wrapping his hands around the baby bump.
Maybe when she has kids, okay, maybe then she'll change her mind and get tested.
Well, fuck you, Danny. What do you care if I get tested or not? You got tested and didn't ask anyone's opinion or permission.
Grabbing my jacket, I stomp for the door saying, you know what? Maybe I'll do whatever I want.
The kitchen door makes a bigger bang than I meant it to as I storm out, but I don't care if the house falls down. I'm sick of Danny trying to run my life, judging me and telling me how to do everything better.
A brown paper bag on the hall table catches my eye. Opening it, I inhale the warm smell of freshly baked muffins. Cinnamon, blueberries, warm sugar, a bouquet of calories. Joanna must have baked them for my father. Taking the bag with me, I slam the front door closed. Chapter 5. A soft breeze plays on my face when I step outside. Tall trees line both sides of the street, a palette of fall colors. I take a few deep breaths to calm myself, then cross the street to Bert and Edith's. From nowhere, Stephen Black jumps into my mind.
I just slept with my boss. Shit, what am I going to do? There's no way I can face him tomorrow.
Maybe I'll ring in sick, or just not show up, or move job, or move city.
Bert's yard is bare, with dusky gray soil where green grass flourished before the summer sun scorched it. After ringing the doorbell, I hear the shuffle of Bert's footsteps and pray the Advil starts working soon. Bert opens the door, a smile tugging at his sagging face. He has one of those funny smiles where only one corner of his lips curls up. He steps back to let me in, calling out to Edith to let her know I've arrived. Habit, I guess. She won't hear him. The strong smell of yesterday's fried chicken makes me want to gag. It's never like that at Dad's. Joanna always has some scent of the month destroying the ozone layer. I used to call it Mom's. I don't know when that changed. But it did. Everything did. There are no more messages on my phone. No more trips to the mall on a Thursday evening for coffee and baker's beans, where we would chat about everything and anything. She always had something for me. A t-shirt, my favorite shampoo, a hat in winter. It was like she could never give me enough. I miss it. Not the stuff. Her.
Following Bert down the hallway is like traveling back in time. The wallpaper, with big yellow flowers on a gray background, has probably been back in fashion twice since they bought it. A carpet of blurred diamond-shaped colors with a pathway worn into it leads us to the back room, the good room, where Edith sits in a chair by a blazing fire. The house is warm, so I'm surprised to see her wrapped in a blanket. Bert glances at me, shaking his head briefly before I walk over and kneel down by her side. "Hi, Edith," I say, speaking close to her good ear.
"Hello, Becca,"
she smiles. Her hand shakes as she attempts to grip mine. She looks about 10 years older than she did 2 weeks ago. Her face has diminished to skin stretched on bone. Her sunken eyes are glass stones in quicksand. Just lifting her head seems to take every ounce of energy she has.
"I baked you some muffins."
I open the bag so she can see inside.
"They look lovely, Becca. You shouldn't have bothered."
She gasps for air between every word.
"It was a pleasure, Edith. You can have them with a cup of tea."
"I'll put them in the pantry for later,"
Bert says loudly. He beckons for me to follow him. Taking the walking stick that's resting on the back of Edith's chair, he leads me into the kitchen.
"What's going on, Bert? How come she's wrapped up like that?"
"We had a bit of bad news this week, Becca."
"When I called in 2 weeks ago, Edith was going into the hospital the following day for some tests."
"How bad?" I say.
6 to 8 weeks, they say."
Tears are gathering in the corner of his eyes. He lifts a frail hand to wipe them away. 6 to 8 weeks is such short notice. I think about Mom and her endless departure and wonder which is easier.
"Does Edith know?"
"She knows she's sick, that she's not getting better."
"Is there anything I can do? I feel like..."
But I can't finish the sentence. Placing his trembling hand on my shoulder, Bert sighs.
"No, everything is being taken care of. The palliative care team are great, and I'll do what I can to make it as pleasant a journey for her as possible."
"You're a good man, Bert. She's a lucky woman to have you."
He smiles, pleased to hear that someone might think him a good man, that someone might think Edith a lucky woman to have him. But I've always had a soft spot for Bert. He always had so much time for me, never forgetting my birthday, always taking an interest in what I was doing. Mom said he was a weirdo, that he was trying to play daddy because he had no kids of his own. I didn't buy it then, and I don't buy it now. Bert is just one of the good guys. Edith has fallen asleep by the time we go back in, her head hanging over the side of the chair. Bert rushes over to pull the cushion into place. My heart is not strong enough for this kind of pain, for the sight of old people struggling just to put the day in. Leaning over Edith, I kiss her papery cheek and tuck the blanket around her shoulders. Something surges through me like an electric current. Mom is lying in a bed 10 miles from here with no one to kiss her goodnight. I need to get back to her, need to see her, to touch my lips to her cheek. Bert sees my face change.
"Are you all right, Becca?"
I turn to hug him, to hold him tight to stop me falling. As frail as he is, he keeps me upright.
"Don't be so sad,"
he says.
"Edith's had a good life."
"I know," I sniffle, stepping back out of his arms. "But Mom is only 55 and she's dying too." He puts his hands on my shoulders, holds me at arm's length, that sad smile tugging down the corner of his lips.
"Becca,"
he says gently,
"your mother
is already dead.
What? Did I just hear right? How dare he?
Mom might have Alzheimer's, her memory and her sense of self so faded that if I told her she was dead, she'd probably smile, but she's still alive, still breathing, still my mom. I'm already opening my mouth to say all this when it occurs to me to wonder if Bert is entirely himself. If the stress of caring for Edith, of nursing his own broken heart, isn't taking its toll. I watch him, bent over at the fireplace, struggling to stoke the fire, keeping the room warm so Edith can decay in peace. This is not a room for confrontation. Let it go.
Goodbye, Edith, I say. Take care, Bert.
When will you be back?
He says, leaving his post by the fireplace to walk me to the door. Probably next week, Bert. I'll do my best.
Good. She gets very lonely, does Edith.
Dad is out on his front porch, waiting for me.
Becca, dinner's getting cold.
He likes to keep the peace, my dad. Hates any sort of row, which can be hard when Danny is around. And I don't want to upset him. He has enough to be worrying about. So I smile and hurry across the street. It's only right I go back and have the dinner Joanna has made, for my dad's sake. Also, I'm hungover, starving, barely hanging in here. If anyone brings up the gene test again, I'm out of there, hungry or not. Chapter 6. Behind the bar, I'm praying for my break to arrive so I can drop another couple of Advil. The hangover is still torturing me, punishing me for my night of debauchery. I wonder if Stephen Black has a hangover. Is he thinking of me? Sorry for what he did or still savoring the pleasure? Picturing the deed with a discreet smile simmering on his face? From the corner of my eye, I see a woman and man making their way towards the bar, conspicuous in their suits. They're not wearing the usual black t-shirts, leather jackets, or anything to suggest that they're faithful rockers. They won't stay long. Oh my God, she has a gun. Her jacket sways and I see the black, heavy-looking piece on her hip. Cops. Something's going down. I try to pull a beer, but I can't stop watching them. They're at the far end of the bar now, speaking to Brian. The male cop is showing him something. He looks younger than his female colleague and must be over 6 feet tall because he's towering over everyone, even Brian. Brian's looking at whatever he's being shown and shaking his head, calling another bar staff member over. Now he's shaking his head too. Then the female cop points up at me. Does she want to talk to me too? I hope not. Cops I can do without right now. I've enough going on in my head, what with having to face Stephen Black and figure out what Mom was ranting about. Slipping out from behind the bar, gin-scented sweat dripping from every pore, I head to the changing room, searching my bag for some Advil. Please be here. Rummaging through the contents, my fingers eventually locating the pills, I hear a knock on the door.
Detective Ivy Turner?
The female cop says while shoving her ID card in my face.
I wonder if I could have a moment of your time.
Sure, I say, standing back to let them in. Beer barrels are the only places to sit in the room, so they remain standing. Turner stares at me, freaking me out, until eventually she asks my name and how long I've worked at Maddie's. Then she shows me a photo.
Do you know this woman?
She says, her eyes focused on mine. No, but isn't she the woman I saw on the news?
Has she ever made contact with you?
No, I've never seen her before.
Are you sure?
I'm certain.
Facebook, Twitter, anything like that?
No, just the news. Shaking my head, I move towards the door. Listen, I say. I have to get back behind the bar. Why do you think I'd know her?
We're asking the questions.
And we're not finished, miss,
the male cop says. But I have to get back to work. Sorry, I have to run.
I hurry down the hallway with my heart pounding louder than the band on stage. I probably shouldn't have bailed like that, but I've never been questioned by cops before, and it made me nervous. Why would they think I know Katie Collins?
Back pulling pints, I see the cops moving through the crowd, showing the photo around. Every now and then, Turner looks over at me, making it hard to concentrate. When I get the chance, I make straight for Brian.
She just asked me if I'd seen the woman in the photo,
he says, when I finally get him alone. Did she say anything about me? Brian stops pouring, looks at me sideways.
Why would she say anything about you?
No reason. I'm just trying to figure out why she questioned me.
She questioned everyone, Becca,
he says, walking away with his drinks.
No need to be paranoid.
Well, at least that's something.
Or it is until I hear Turner's voice in my ear, dead, as if coming through a device that removes any evidence of personality. A quick word before you go,
Turner says. About what? Fuck, why won't she leave me alone? She flicks through her notebook, stops, and nods to herself.
Rebecca, right?
I nod.
Okay, Rebecca, I need you to really think about this. It's very important. Are you certain Katie Collins didn't get in contact with you?
Her staring is making me nervous, like she's trying to see behind my eyes into my head. I'm not getting why I'm being questioned for a second time. No, she didn't. I'm certain. She hands me a card with her name and number on it.
Rebecca, I need you to go home and check all your social media accounts. Contact me when you've done it.
I don't get it, I say. Why would you think she'd get in touch with me?
Because she was trying to contact a woman who works in the bar in this club, and you're the only female working in this bar. She came to Boston looking for you.
Chapter 7. I'm awake all night. No chance of sleep.
All kind of crazy ideas going through my head.
Is it possible Turner is right? That Katie Collins is looking for me? But if so, why hasn't she found me? I'm not that difficult to locate. And where is she now? And now, totally paranoid and sleepless when the last thing I need is more grief, I hear Mom's voice whispering, I took you, Becca. What if she's telling the truth? If Mom did take me, I wouldn't have a birth certificate or photos of her holding me after giving birth at the hospital. But what if? Standing by the window in one of Mom's old t-shirts, I watch the world pass by below. People going about their normal daily grind, heading to offices, shops, cafes.
Well, I won't be heading to the office today. The idea of facing Stephen Black is just too much.
And here it comes again, the guilt flushing through my body, torturing my conscience. Why did I sleep with someone else's husband? What if his wife finds out? Oh my God, his poor wife. Bit late now. Mom always told me to find a gentleman. Someone who will treat you right, Becca. That's all you need. Someone who makes you feel you are the queen of their world. Someone to love you. Someone to love me. If only she knew, she would not be happy. I wonder, is she happy? Is she anything? Happy? Sad? Scared? Scared was the worst part of the diagnosis. For me, anyway. The tears that flowed when she remembered she had forgotten. The panic, the terror in her eyes, gasping like she was drowning, knowing there was only one direction this diagnosis was going. It seems like all we did was cry in those early days.
The first time she didn't recognize me, I was devastated. She'd sent me to the store for tomatoes, but when I came back, she just looked blankly at me and smiled politely as if I was a stranger. "Hello," she said, before walking out of the kitchen. At first, I thought she was joking. She joked a lot when I was a kid.